go ahead and dive into this, our fourth session about hymnody and musical meaning. Today's section, as I recall, entitled Hymnody as Classical Music Sampler. This is a unique session among the five of the week in that we really do have a very particular kind of historical event, a historical phenomenon that we're going to be talking about and working our way through the implications of, both the way this historical phenomenon continues to resonate in our hymnody in the present day, but also looking back at where it actually took place, at the heart of the beast, when this this particular moment in the history of hymnody actually came along, and what it looked like. I'm referring to a moment in the 19th century that began around 1821, when a banker in Savannah, Georgia, named Lowell Mason, who was also a choir conductor and a singer and an organist, Lowell Mason had pieced together what he thought would be the kind of hymnal, or the kind of hymn collection that could really redeem American music making, American hymn singing. And he had finally, in 1821, talked the Boston Handel and Haydn Society into publishing this thing. And thus it was published, Lowell Mason's first volume of hymnody under the title of the Boston Handel and Haydn Society Collection of Church Music. This turned out to be a runaway bestseller, sold about 50,000 copies by the time all was said and done, which in those times was an awful lot of copies for a hymn book. But what was distinctive about Lowell Mason's Boston Handel and Haydn Society collection of church music is that the majority of the tunes in it were based on pieces of European classical music, which was something you very rarely found in American hymnody before that time. In 1812, there had appeared a volume in London. William Gardiner had published a volume called Sacred Melodies in London in 1812, Sacred Melodies drawn from Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven. And in that volume, Gardiner had harvested tunes from Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven, fit them with hymn words, and published them thus. But it was in 1821 that Americans got their first glimpse of this. This kind of phenomenon would turn out to be perhaps the single most important phenomenon in terms of shaping the American musical educational experience of the first half of the 19th century, which is to say, from 1821 through 1855 or so, to the eve of the Civil War. Many, many hymnals were published. Thousands of hymnals were published, which included, in the aggregate, hundreds of adaptations, probably thousands of adaptations of European classical music, which is to say, the editors of the hymnals listen to classical pieces and think, well, there's a neat tune that Beethoven came up with there. Let's sort of snatch that tune up, set it in four parts like a hymn, stick hymn words to it, and treat it like a hymn. We do have some of these left. I would ask you to grab a hymnal if you don't have one yet. We have a few up here. There are some available at the door. And turn to page 676. And give a look to what we find there. Lord, speak to us that we may speak. Once you get to page 676, if you go to the very bottom line of text there on the page, you will see the music is by Robert Schumann, who lived from 1810 to 1856. Helpful stuff. This is a 19th century adaptation that is still with us today, one of the ones that has lingered on in our hymnals. What I'd like to do is listen to the piece this comes from. It is from what's more popularly called a nocturne, but what Schumann himself called a Nachtstück. A piano piece by Schumann, one of a collection of four piano pieces, Opus 23, this is number four, by Robert Schumann. Schumann spent most of his career in Leipzig. He was a friend of Felix Mendelssohn's. He knew Franz Liszt and Hector Berlioz and all kinds of other people. He traveled in some pretty heady circles. He was best known throughout his career for his piano music. He was not the best piano player alive by any stretch of the imagination, but his piano works have this kind of intimacy that one rarely finds in any other composer of the time, even much more sort of flashy, much more brilliant composers Let us give a listen to about 2 minutes of this Schumann Nachtstück, and then sing the hymn on which it's based, or from which, sing the hymn based on it. Here we go, Schumann's original Nachtstück. This is a kind of transition into the piece. Editor just snipped it there. That's the hymn. Schumann goes on. And as we can hear, Schumann's piece sets in motion actually a series of kind of departure and return schemes. We'll keep coming back to this melody. And the melody sometimes varied somewhat. You get the idea. And the Schumann piece goes on for about 2 more minutes. That said, let us sing this hymn. I am ready to sit down at the piano and butcher these things all morning long, but do we have a capable pianist in the room who'd like to, take the honors? Okay. We're talking about 676, if you can give us a couple bars for nothing. Let's sing one verse of Lord Speak to Us. Something of this, three and a half minute Schumann piece. I mean, is this okay? Are we, what do we think of this practice? There are no right answers, by the way.
It's okay. It marries good music to good text.
Should be more of it.
Should be more of it. Great. Well, there used to be. Well, let me tell you what Eric Routley said about it. I've quoted Routley before. Some of you have been in more than one of these sessions. Eric Routley is probably the single greatest hymnologist of the last half century, the late Eric Routley, an Anglican himself, but published dozens of books on various topics concerning church music, hymnody in particular. And in his 1981 Music of Christian Hymns, probably his magnum opus, he dedicates about a page to the kind of adaptations that we're talking about, which is to say, not very long in this 600-page book. And here we are, one of the most important phenomena of 19th century hymnody. He gives it about a page, and then he wraps it all up saying, quote, "The morality of this sort of thing is in our own time very properly questioned. And such adaptations from great classics as we are left with have proved mostly to be an embarrassment, which popular taste will not allow us to get rid of." What do we think? I mean, are you going to throw your lungs? What?
Thank goodness.
Yeah, right. Okay. Nobody seems too offended here.
I'm offended.
I'm not. Are you offended?
Yeah.
We'll come back.
Right.
Go ahead.
I'm not, if it's a poorly done, event, and it's rather offensive, but in a sense, you hear this piece in church, if you're not familiar with the Schumann piece, you go out into the wider world and you hear it at a concert or someplace, and it brings you back to that place again where you heard that hymn, and you say, well, what was that text I was talking about? So yeah. It connects it in a larger way than if you just go up for your 60 minutes of church a week and hear a hymn and take off and never hear it again.
Interesting.
So there's a weaving it into the social fabric or the outside world, outside the church building.
Then we'll have to come back to that. That's an interesting idea. You have a different take.
Actually, it seems snobbish. And it seems like if there's great music that in those days only the elite could hear, mm-hmm. and you didn't have DVDs then, if snippets of it were taken to put to sacred words, surely that was a good cultural sharing across sort of traditions mm-hmm. there.
Yeah.
But would have Schumann sanctioned that?
Well, he probably wouldn't have, but... I mean, in a way, you know, we quote from Shakespeare in other literature and poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a form of quotation, mm-hmm. great music, and he should have made it.
I bet Routley would have loved all the folk songs that were stolen and put to sacred texts.
Yeah. I mean, when you think of some of the things Vaughan Williams left us with a couple of years into the 20th century, whenever it was, 1906 or something, that Ray Vaughan Williams' English hymnal came out, an incredibly influential book, from which we get such tunes as Sine Nomine, but all kinds of other English folk song adaptations. This is one of Vaughan Williams' favorite things. Now, is that a different, why do you bring those up? I mean, is that the same kind of thing, or is that a different kind of thing, or what, I mean?
I'm thinking of Luther's line, the devil shouldn't get all the good tunes.
Right.
And so although Luther wrote lots of his own tunes, the Reformation period borrowed folk songs and wrote texts to them.
Yep.
And drinking songs.
Mm-hmm. And drinking songs. And motets and stuff. And I mean, that is all kinds of music, high and low, is there sort of for the culling. Now, is classical music a special case? I mean, Schumann is a genius, after all. And what makes these things, I mean, his kind of piano music great? And this seems trivial in that we like to believe it about every kind of classical music that exists, but it's not true of most classical music, but it is true of Schumann. Every note is in the right place. There isn't a note wasted, there's not a note too many. That these kinds of piano pieces are distillations of sort of perfect musical thought. Is that something different than just sort of hauling green sleeves out, or I mean, some English folk tune that is a folk tune, doesn't belong to anybody, wasn't authored by anybody that we know of. Is it a different thing to do this to Schumann than it is to do it to an English?
So is this an intellectual property issue?
Well, yeah, I guess. Or you tell me, is it an intellectual property?
Well, we don't have any hymns by Schoenberg, right?
No, we don't have any hymns by Schoenberg. Though Eric Routley, the fellow I just quoted, was a pretty sort of highbrow kind of guy. And the hymn tunes he actually wrote are incredibly complicated things, by and large, some of them just unusably so. But, yeah.
You can take the flip side of that as well, for those of us that write music and an occasional tune here and there, for us to assume that we can take a poem that has been written and make it somehow better by mm-hmm. putting a tune to it. Wasn't the poetry enough by itself? So, I mean, there's always that question. I've gotten that from people before, as I've set poems into music for church. So wasn't this enough without this tune to it?
Yeah.
Well, it probably was.
Right.
So I think you can't come up with an answer here. But
that is a great way to come at the problem. When we think in particular of, say, Franz Peter Schubert, who really invented the art song, I mean, the German Lied as we understand it, Schubert really was the first composer to understand just what the genre was capable of. He made it what it was. It's not that it hadn't existed before, but Schubert had the kind of artistic insight, gave it the artistic gravitas. His Opus 1 is a setting of Goethe's Erlkönig. And there we are with Goethe, this poet and, you know, botanist and fiction writer and everything. You know, Goethe, such an important figure in the history of German culture that, you know, the Germans refer to Goethe's lifetime as the Goethe site, you know, the time during which Goethe was around. Anyway, Schubert sends off his setting of Goethe's poem Erlkönig to Goethe. Errol Kearney has turned out to be perhaps the single most important 19th century lead. It's like, you know, the Beethoven's Ninth Symphony of the lead world. And there's no indication that Goethe liked it at all. He never responded to Schubert on the topic of Schubert's setting of that song. And his favorite setting of Errol Kearney was this very simple-minded little plodding thing from another composer, which is just a little trivial thing compared to what Schubert had done. Now, Goethe tended to prefer very simple musical settings. And so the answer may be, who cares? You know, if you've got Schubert's Errol Kearney in front of you, who cares what Goethe thought of this poem? Schubert made it his own. And perhaps we're talking about the same kind of appropriation. That's a wonderful angle. That said, let's come to a more classic case, 270, in which we have actual sort of evidence along these lines. 270 is a tune many of you will probably have heard before, Hark the Herald Angels Sing. In the companion to the Lutheran Book of Worship, we get a little blurb on every hymn as it goes by, and our hymnal companion writer there says that this is perhaps the most famous English language hymn in existence. And who knows, we could duke that out. But suffice to say, Hark the Herald Angels Sing has enjoyed a pretty good history. Here's the deal. As many of you will know, Mendelssohn wrote this tune not with these words in mind. He wrote it as a part of a Festgesang, a sort of festive song, or festive cantata, to Gutenberg, the inventor of the printing press. Vaterland in deinen Gauen brach der goldene Tag eins an. You know, in your region's fatherland once broke the light of day. And then we get to this middle section. Gutenberg, du deutsche Mann, Gutenberg, you German man. And so this was out there, and this was a famous song. I mean, it was published in the Zeitschrift für Musik. You know, when they did the write-up of this concert, they said, okay, here's this tune, and they actually published tunes in those days and said, look, you know, here's a classic in the making. Everybody understood this was a great tune. Mendelssohn's English publishers, I've told this story once already this week very briefly, but Mendelssohn's English publishers, you know, wrote to Mendelssohn and said, look, we've got to publish this thing, but nobody knows who Gutenberg is over here. We don't care about Gutenberg. He's, or, you know, people may know who he is, but he's not a national hero. So let's just make this a religious song, a jubilate or something like that. And Mendelssohn wrote back and said, this cannot be a religious song. This is a nationalistic song. It would never work as a religious song. And here we are with Hark the Herald Angels Sing, maybe the most successful hymn in the hymnal, or one of them. Let's sing it and then ask what we can do with Mendelssohn. Done in 1856 by a fellow named Cummings, an organ player who hatched this idea, published in Schoep's, I can't remember the name of the hymn book, but in about 1857. Within a decade, it had made its way into American hymnals and the fire, you know, had started. How does this work? That is, to return to the actual sort of nominal topic of this week's entire conversation, what makes this work as a hymn tune? I mean, if we're all ready to kind of say, that's fine, you can, I mean, you grab at those classical pieces, stick the words to them, see what happens. What makes this one work? I mean, what sort of measure by measure, chunk by chunk, why does this work so well as a hymn tune?
Well, it's very singable.
It is very singable. What makes it singable and catchy, do you suppose?
Good music.
It's good what?
It's good composition.
Yeah.
Good composition.
It is. can we get that any, I mean, I'm a musicologist and I say stuff like this all the time, and I always feel like I'm falling down on the job. Look, it's a great tune. But sometimes that's what you got. You got a great tune. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's an incredibly sturdy thing, the way it plots out its climaxes and builds and stuff. And I mean, it's, yeah, it's a really good tune.
Except it's actually not that singable. I always think it's impossible with a female voice who's not a good voice. I never can reach those high notes.
Yeah.
I mean, somehow those songs, those hymns that sort of stay in a single octave work better.
Great. Yeah. In early 20th century pop music, the rule was always one octave plus one note. That's how far you can get, a ninth total. And that's what we get here. But, I mean, yeah, that's why I sing bass all the time. I can't hit any of those notes. So, yeah, I mean, I sympathize. But how does it respond to the words? That is, I mean, one nice thing about this hymn is that it's not just that we have a really good tune and a really, of course, you know, very sturdy set of words. They really do go nicely together. How do they? I mean, in a couple of sort of particular instances, what about the first line? Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn king. Anything, why does it work so well?
The glory is at the top of the beeper, the pitch.
Sounds great. I mean, glory is obviously the most important word that we got there, and it gets the grand climax. And even more important than, you know, hark or something like that, you know, glory is the big blowout. Then obviously, too, we have these two different kinds of chunks of the scale being set up. Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's one chunk, the bottom half, and then we get the top half. Ba-da-ba-ba-da-da-da. And what makes those two different? Well, the narrator gets the bottom half, and the angels get the top half, which is to say, as long as we're telling you what's about to happen, hark the herald angels sing, you know, that's the narrator kind of talking you into the story. When the song itself comes along, and the angels actually pop out with the song, you know, that's where, you know, we enter a whole new realm. Glory to the newborn king. And the same thing happens in along a kind of different axis as we get into the refrain, where we have this very peculiar thing, as far as hymnody is concerned, two-part writing, where the four parts are really stripped down to two parts, and so bass and tenor, that is in the first system of the second page, hark the herald angels sing, the bass and tenor sing almost, well, exactly what the soprano and alto are singing, almost exactly. So in other words, we start that out with two-part writing, hark the herald angels sing, again, the narrator tells us that much. When the angels themselves open their mouth for the last time, the four parts blossom once more, glory to the newborn king. So in both instances, we have this neat kind of divide between the narrator saying, hark, the herald angels sing, and the angel song itself. You know, for those and many kinds of reasons, it's just an amazingly good lining up of text and tune. Apart from just being a very good, tune. I had planned at this moment on turning to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee. But we're not going to sing it. And the reason we're not going to sing it is because I don't like it. It's one of my sort of least favorite hymns in the book. So let's talk about why I don't like Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee.
Could we sing it first?
Okay, let's sing it first. 836, if you will. On page 836, we get an adaptation, which is, again, one of the most popular tunes in the book. This based, of course, on the folk song that comprises the subject of the Hemann Variations movement that forms the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. This was, I'm almost sure, the longest symphonic movement that had ever been composed at that point. It's an enormous choral movement with which Beethoven wraps up his Ninth Symphony. It is based on a very simple folk song, it's not a folk song, Beethoven composed it, but a folksy song, and thus do we sing it. Let's sing Joyful, Joyful.
Oh, is it that I mean, I don't know.
It's so emotional. Okay. I always want to cry and rejoice when I sing this song.
Okay.
So why do you hate it?
Well, tell me first. Do we all feel the same way? Is this kind of everyone's favorite tune in the book? I shouldn't have gone on the record.
It could use some better text.
Yeah. Well, so could Beethoven. But yeah.
My pastor at church knows that he puts, you know, when I'm gone for a weekend, he'll put this in.
Tell me more. What's your pastor?
Well,
does he know?
Well, he knows that I don't particularly care for it. He's not musically literate enough for me to have explained necessarily why. I'm not sure he's listened to the choral movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. But it's for a bass, it's a rather monotonous bass part. And I miss the punch into the last phrase. You know, it just takes that rhythmic vitality out of that ending, just sucks it out for me. But I regularly hear from other people, this is just a great hymn, I love this song. Okay, then. That's good. It works
great.
For many, many, many people.
And of course, the rhythmic punch he's referring to, for those at all familiar with the Ninth Symphony, is there's one thing of rhythmic interest that occurs in this tune, and it's been eradicated in hymn form. You're supposed to get out of the bridge with da 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 bum ba da 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 bum ba ba da, and you know it's syncopated. There's one site of syncopation, and that's that you know when the main tune returns, it comes back a beat too early, as it were. But it's just kind of too weird in the context of a hymn, and so you know out it goes. Say more. Is there anybody else who sympathizes?
Well, it strikes me as a bit screech-like. So you've got three bars here, or you know, three lines that are very highly ranged. It's just that third one, that seems like it's more moderate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a congregation or group that is maybe a bit musically challenged,
mm-hmm.
it might not be the best sound.
Now you were busting Mendelssohn's chops for Hark the Herald Angels Sing, but this you like. I mean, it does have plenty of high notes too. Or
yeah, this. I mean, I'm.
But this one's worth it, maybe.
I just find it emotion.
Yeah.
I think there's a way to intellectualize music
mm-hmm.
that divorces it from the emotions that it may evoke.
Yeah.
And of course, when I hear this, I'm also sort of thinking of Beethoven's. Somehow it's there in my mind as well. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's a way more powerful instantiation of this melody. But I don't know, I find it very emotional. So
in 1989, when the wall came down, this, now, of course, not Van Dyck's text, but Schiller's text.
Mm-hmm.
This is the tune that Germans wanted to sing when they gathered at the wall.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the opening of one of the more recent Olympics, there were choirs all over the world, and CNN would cut to these choirs all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So China, South Africa, India, Australia. And I found that extremely emotional as well, that all over the world people sort of feel something about this melody.
Yeah. Well, I think they do, and I'm not going to be a wet blanket. There's nothing wrong with that. In a certain sense, I guess it comes down to how I feel about Beethoven as a tune writer. Well, let me propose this, and then you all can come back and say, no, that's crazy, or you can say, yes, but we don't care. But here's the deal. To me, the tune, I mean, this melody itself is one of the least interesting features of that choral piece. I mean, Beethoven had written variations on some very stupid melodies, and this is part of his genius, is to take sort of simple things and turn them sort of in variation form into beautiful flowing things. And to me, that's always kind of how this movement has struck me, that the melody is sturdy enough, but you know, it's scarcely the most interesting thing about this movement. And in fact, if you take out the last 30 minutes of the movement and leave only this melody, I mean, it just seems like there's not enough Beethoven left. I mean, this isn't really what we hire Beethoven for, is to write, catchy melodies.
Well, he wasn't a melodic composer. His genius was in, the harmonizations and the developments. It's not a very...
That's not a great tune.
Yeah,
that's right.
Everybody knows it.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't have to get off on this particular train. I mean, that's exactly what I mean, is that, I mean, in a certain sense, I've always suspected that the reason Beethoven's music got so enormous and so strange and so harmonically challenging, motivically challenging, and all that, is that he felt as though his melodic gifts, you know, so completely paled compared to his predecessors, that Mozart and Haydn, to my mind, are both infinitely better melodists than Beethoven was. So, I mean, now and then he had on some extraordinarily good melodies, but Mozart just bled this stuff. I mean, Mozart could just come up with great melodies all day long. And so one kind of wonders if it isn't, I mean, I think it's true, he wasn't the great melodic genius. I'd rather not have this argument. Let's press on to other things. We'll press on to a curious case this one comes in the form of a handout. Here's one for our pianist. What I'm handing out here is a setting of Felix Mendelssohn's part song called Ruetal, The Valley of Peace. And I do not have a complete text of this song in front of me. It is a part song, which is to say it was written for soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, a cappella. And it was written as a genre of music, Lieder in Freie zu singen, in Freie. I remember the German grammar, but songs to be sung in the out-of-doors. This was the genre. So basically, when you've been singing, you know, at choir practice all night, and then you're walking home through the woods with your friends, you know, Mendelssohn wanted to provide you with songs that, you know, choristers could just go out in the out-of-doors to sing. This Ruetal is one of them. In another 19th century adaptation, adapted to a set of words I think we all probably have heard before, Rock of Ages, Cleft for Me. This page does have two sides, by the way. It's the Rock of Ages side that interests us now. What I'm going to suggest is that we first turn to page 623 in our hymnal and sing the Rock of Ages that most of us will probably be familiar with, and then turn to the Mendelssohn Rock of Ages. And I'm going to sort of talk my way into this. As it happens, adaptations of Mendelssohn tunes in 19th century America have been a fixation of mine for several years now. I have not one but two articles that have come out this year on this topic, on the topic of Mendelssohn adaptations in 19th century American hymnody, because he presents such an interesting case. I mean, in part it's because I'm a Mendelssohn scholar, that's sort of what I do is work on Mendelssohn, but Mendelssohn was one of the great favorites of these American hymn editors who were into, adaptations of this kind. By the end of the 19th century, long story short, Mendelssohn dies in 1847. By the 10th anniversary of his death, 1857, nearly 40 different Mendelssohn melodies had gotten adapted for use as hymns. And Hark the Herald Angels Sing wasn't even on the table yet. We're talking about 40 that we've never heard of. By the end of the century, there were another 20 or so that had come out. Dozens and dozens of Mendelssohn tunes were getting used. The place he appears first is in an 1841 volume called the Carmina Sacra, another Lowell Mason book. This contains the first American publication of a Mendelssohn tune in hymn tune form. This was the best-selling book of Mason's career, sold about 500,000 copies. There are around 23 million Americans at the time, so you know, approximately one out of 56 men, women, and children in the United States at some point went out and bought a copy of this book, Mason's Carmina Sacra. It was the best-selling music publication in history. And it introduced Mendelssohn in hymn form to Americans. Most Americans had never heard of Mendelssohn. Most Americans had never heard a melody of Mendelssohn. Yes, if you lived in New York or Boston or Philadelphia, and you happened to be somebody who liked going to concerts, you would probably have heard an oratorio or a smaller choral work at some point. But most Americans, you know, the 500,000 folks out there buying the Carmina Sacra, most of them had probably never heard a note of Mendelssohn's music. And so this is how they got it. This is not the tune that showed up in the Carmina Sacra. It showed up a few years later, this setting of Rock of Ages. But there's the pep talk. Now, curiously, in 1849, Mendelssohn was got his first big sort of explosive appearance on the American scene in the form of a whole collection of choral music called the Mendelssohn Collection. It wasn't all music of Mendelssohn. It only had about eight Mendelssohn tunes in it, but the whole hymnal got to be called the Mendelssohn Collection. One of the co-editors of that volume, one was William Bradbury, the other was Thomas Hastings.
Thomas Hastings is the author of the tune that we ordinarily sing Rock of Ages with. So, let us first sing Thomas Hastings' setting of Rock of Ages, Cleft for Me, the one that appears on 623 in the hymnal, and then we'll turn to the one by Mendelssohn, the kind of tune that Hastings would turn out to play an important role in sort of importing to the American scene. That's probably more history than you actually needed, but let's dive in. A 623 Rock of Ages, Cleft for Me, we'll sing it the way we know it, then turn to the other one. Turn to Mendelssohn's Rock of Ages. Again, a tune he never intended for this purpose. He had another folk song, another text in mind, but it got used in American books thus. Not ever been sung at all for 100 years. Congratulations, you all. I'm just saying, for what may be literally the first time it's been performed in 100 years, this hymn. It sort of came and went in the course of the 19th century, just didn't happen to catch on. Should it have caught on? What do we think of these two tunes set side by side? What are the virtues, the failings?
It's hard, we're too used to this.
The other.
Hastings. Mm-hmm. Way too used to it.
Good. So it's difficult to imagine any other tune.
I have always just despised that first one. I'm not a musicologist, but I call it schmaltzy. It repels me.
Yeah.
I hate it too.
Yeah. Okay, why do you hate it? This one.
For me it's always the cultural association. So I associate it with late 19th century circuit riding preachers and people living terrible lives on the prairie, and sort of that 19th century piety, and it's depressing.
And you're just not into it. And do you want to say more about your objections to it?
No, schmaltzy captures it all.
Okay, great.
Of course, Schubert was the king of schmaltz.
Well, yeah.
More schmaltz than anybody, but artistically.
Right. Yeah, schmaltz is one of those words like kitsch. I mean, a lot of the stuff I love probably is technically kitsch, but I wish we had a value-neutral word for that sort of thing. But, okay. Other thoughts about Top Lady to begin with, this first tune, da-da-dum-bum-bum-ba-da. Thoughts about it?
It's become kind of an icon for that period, I think. Mm-hmm. And anytime you see a movie, a little church service, there can be some warbling women singing this tune.
Yeah.
In kind of poor fashion. But that's...
The piano that sounds like it
belongs in a bar. The piano that sounds like it belongs in a bar. Yeah. And this notion of an icon, this to me is kind of a polyvalent word to bring to it, that it's an icon not only in the fact that it's this, it has this kind of symbolic presence that transcends its intrinsic artistic worth, but also, the way that icons are stylized, that somehow, the visual icon is a stylized thing. We don't look at icons the way that we look at the Mona Lisa. And in a sense, we don't listen to this tune as a piece of music, so much as we listen to it as kind of our remembering of a piece of music and all of our associations with a piece of music, that nobody, and this was the first thing out of one of your mouths, we just can't get this tune out of our head somehow when it comes to this set of words. It's just, it is what it is, and we've heard it so many times, there's no getting away from it. It's a curious fact that a lot of the people at work in this period of Mason, Lowell Mason, and Thomas Hastings, there were other people at work in this circle trying to cull these European tunes. And of course, part of their job was to bring in the European tunes. Part of their job was to write new tunes of their own. But as we reflected a couple days ago, listening to Lowell Mason's Hamburg, there's an interesting sense in the in which the tunes through which they tried to get at the kind of rightness of the European sound, the solidity of the European sound, are often exceedingly trivial tunes. And in a certain sense, if you look at the tunes they adapted and the tunes that they wrote, the new American tunes they wrote sort of on the European model, you wonder, why did they write such sort of impoverished tunes, talking about things like Mason's Hamburg when I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died. You know, there are ways in which this is a wonderful tune for this text, but just as a tune, there's just almost nothing there. The same with Redheads Go to Dark Gethsemane. Da 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 da. It's just like a non-event. There's just almost no art there. And with Rock of Ages, it's true that by the time you get to the midpoint of Top Lady, da 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 bum bum ba dum ba da 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 ba da 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 da. That's the tune, and then you're just repeating chunks of that, da 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 da, which is to say, you know, half of the tune consists of repetitions of stuff we've already heard. It is a fairly simple tune. Now, in the case of Mendelssohn, we don't repeat a single measure. That is, we start at the beginning, we sing straight to the end, and there's just new stuff coming at us the whole time. I'm sorry to do this to you, our capable accompanist, but let us sing the Mendelssohn one more time, and then we'll see what Mendelssohn gives us. Actually, we're going to replace Top Lane with this. Would that be cause for rejoicing, or what would we do?
Revolt,
okay. Well, let's pretend we've never heard Top Lady. Let's pretend we didn't have a tune in mind for this text. Does the Mendelssohn tune work, or does it kind of not work, and on what terms, yes or no?
It's one of those hymns that I think it would take you a while to get adjusted to.
Okay.
For me, that's why I learned music, hearing it. But it's not predictable in that sense.
Okay, not predictable. I mean, that's, there may not be a better word to bring to the table than predictable. That is, well, somebody say more.
For my taste, it has a strength and a power to it that seems to me to match the words much better than that schmaltzy.
Yeah. Well, I have to agree, but what are the rest of us? And the thing is, matching the words, this is one thing I happen to care deeply about, and I think this tune does it extraordinarily well. That is one of about six things that a hymn tune has to do right in order to really be a good hymn tune. So yes, I think it matches the words superbly. Was that a hand up to go up? Or
no?
No.
Okay.
It takes effort to do this. This is not easy
for
a layperson to do.
The melody line has a very large range.
He broke the rule. He, you know, again, he's supposed to get one octave and one more note at ninth. He does an octave and then two more notes. So we have to go all the way from here. That is, nobody can comfortably, I mean, lay people, can't really go from here up to here. That's a very wide range for a tune. And that extra note, now, that extra note hurts. Ways of coming in.
I had the interesting experience, having never seen this tune before, I couldn't tell for sure whether I was making mistakes or whether these irritating chromaticisms were were there on purpose. Yes. Then A flat, and then the F sharp. What are they doing there?
Well, it's metal.
Yeah. There is no D sharp in this piece, but apart from that, we hit every black and white key on the piano. That is, every note of the chromatic scale gets covered, except one, at some point in this thing. There's a lot of chromaticism in this. How about Top Lady, if we still have it open? Thomas Hastings doesn't have a single accidental, no sharps and flats. I mean, it's in the key of B flat, but there are no sharps and flats. And Mendelssohn hits all of them. I mean, he hits every note in the scale, except for D sharp. So what did you finally make of that? I mean, of the chromaticism, you just find it irritating.
Well, it feels like it takes a lot of work to sing it.
Great.
On the other hand, I fully agree. I think Rock of Ages is like a beginning guitar tune.
Yeah.
You need about three chords, a lot of dominant sevenths.
Yep. And as for that, if we're into dominant sevenths and such talk, yeah, there are only three chords in Rock of Ages. Except for that G minor that gets stuck in the sort of last time through, but yeah, there are really only sort of 1, 4, and 5 chords in Rock of Ages, in Top Lady, the first tune, and this is just all over the map. Okay, why does it fit the words so well to those of us who kind of sympathize and think, you know, actually, this is right up there with Hark the Herald Angels Sing, in terms of how well the tune actually goes with the words. Can we put a finer point on that? Or?
Well, it's rock-like.
How so?
It's powerful. It's sturdy. You feel like maybe you're mountain climbing.
Okay. And what's sturdy about it? I mean, again, you know, as the Hark the Herald Angels Sing, let's look at the first line. What's so darn sturdy about it?
It's on a C chord.
Well, yeah, the bass, for one thing, just kind of hammers along. Rock of Ages, cleft for me. Let me hide myself in thee. You know, the bass does this thing. And for some reason, this annoys me in the bridge of Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee, when the bass just gets stuck on that D forever. But here, if that's what you're singing about is a rock, I think it's very nice. That the whole, all these sort of melodic travails, you know, are anchored by this C, this kind of hammering thing that's not going anywhere. And when does it go anywhere? Well, it goes somewhere when we trade in the image of Jesus as rock to references to sort of sacramental body, blood, that kind of thing. As soon as we start talking about the riven side, as soon as we start talking about the blood that flows, the bass starts to flow. Let the water and the blood, you know, and so it goes. And suddenly the bass becomes this sort of fluid thing. You know, things start to move around. And so as long as the rock is our operative metaphor, the bass is motionless. When that metaphor goes away and we start to contemplate sadder things, the bass starts to slide up. Other thoughts, other ways of coming at this? There's also the fact that, you know, what is the riven side? I mean, there really is a we sing it so many times we don't think about it, but, you know, it's a pretty brutal image that we get the riven side. And what do we get there? Well, the melody gives us our first, this is the first accidental, the first sharp or flat that's actually shown up in the melody itself, the F sharp. From thy riven side which flowed. You know, and it's as though it's this violation of the natural order, this F sharp that creeps into the melody. For the first time, you know, the melody singers have to sing a, an accidental. You know, to my mind, it matches the text extremely convincingly.
Yeah. I was just gonna say, revealing myself fully as a non-musician, I went to Wagner's Ring last week. And so there you have these wonderful little phrases that evoke nature and personalities and themes and so forth. Wonderful, wonderful. I don't find any lovely little phrases in here that evoke the rock or the ribbon side. Or
okay.
I think Wagner would have done a better job with this text, to tell you the truth.
This is like the golf.
Yeah. And again, for the most of you, this is my wife here, who knows me well enough to understand.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I even Wagner and I. Well.
You don't know.
Bad
Wagner
blood.
Was cruel.
Yeah, Wagner, right. And as many of us will be aware. Yeah, in 51, Wagner, 1851, Wagner published an anonymous article under the name Freigedanke, the free thinker, the free thought, an anonymous article called the Judaism in Music, which was largely about Mendelssohn, about how the Jews had led, you know, all of German music astray. And, you know, it begins by saying, well, look, everybody understands that the Jew is repellent to look at. Now we understand, you know, we have to start learning how repellent the music is as well, that there appears to be lifeblood in it, but you know, there's really not any lifeblood there. You know, Wagner was a rabid anti-Semite. And so what do you do with the fact that he's also such a brilliant composer? And, yes, and I'd simply prostrate myself before the ring. I mean, this is an amazing, amazing musical experience. There's absolutely nothing like it. But I don't know what to do about that fact. How many of us have seen Wagner's Ring of the Nibelungen? We've, yeah, I mean, these four massive music dramas, as he called them, 4 or 5 hours each. And they,
it's Hate the Sin and Love the Sinner.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, that is, we can forgive Wagner for the bad things that he did long enough to, you know, at least take in his music. Wagner did write some songs, and I actually had the good fortune of comparing two settings of the two Grenadiers, whatever our English translation is, of the text that both Wagner and Robert Schumann set. And I'm pleased to say that by almost any standard, Schumann's setting just towers over Wagner's setting of this text. Though when Wagner actually did try to work on a smaller scale, you know, he isn't nearly as interesting as when he's working on the 4-hour scale. But that what?
Yes, they have a full symphony argument.
Yeah, that's right. But I know what you mean about these little hooks that grab us. And obviously, okay, I mean, I got off to sort of get on my soapbox about Wagner for a bit. But your point here is that you just don't find this tune catchy somehow. Is that it? There's not kind of a hook there. Yeah.
I think this would be certainly more challenging for a congregation to sing than the other, even if they hadn't known topic to start with.
Yeah.
I'm not arguing for use of top eight, it's not one of my favorite hymns.
Mm-hmm.
But this would be more difficult for people to just pick up.
Yeah.
Sitting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do happen to like the thing, but the fact is I've spent a lot of time with this tune too. Yeah.
Well, I like it so much that I sort of moved to a practical question. Is there any chance of this appearing in any Lutheran hymnal anytime soon?
Well, all I can say on this subject is that I'm doing my that in the next issue of Cross Accent, the Lutheran Church Musician, the Journal of the Lutheran Church Musicians Association, I do have an article coming out, of which this is a part, but it basically puts forward 5 settings, you know, the 5 best Mendelssohn hymns that you never heard is, you know, kind of the shtick, but 5 19th century Mendelssohn settings, you know, this is one of them, that seem to work, you know, extraordinarily well for what they are. And I offer up these sort of editions of them. There's one on the other side, too. It came upon the midnight clear. And I realize there is not the remotest chance that any actual congregation out there is going to trade in the tune that we know to It Came Upon the Midnight Clear. But we have here a setting of It Came Upon the Midnight Clear based on a Mendelssohn piano piece, the first of his so-called Songs Without Words, which is, in fact, a very interesting setting of this song. This one happens to be English in origins. It was arranged by a fellow named E.J. Hopkins, a lawyer who also did some of this kind of thing. But it quickly caught on in the United States and was a big hit. And I think we should close today with my making this little plug for this arrangement of It Came Upon the Midnight Clear. Again, this is a kind of distillation of a much longer piano piece of Mendelssohn's.
I'll play it all the way through, maybe, since...
Okay. Thank you. thank you all very much for coming today, and thank you for...